As our brother James said, we're glad to be together tonight to open God's Word and to study together, to encourage each other through that effort. Already we should have been able to say that we've been encouraged by virtue of what we've done already tonight. And I invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Matthew, the 5th chapter, where we're going to spend almost the entirety of our time tonight, as we have done in each of the preceding 6 sermons up until this point. We have been talking about the Beatitudes, and we have called our study quite simply the basis for real or true or lasting happiness. And we're going to continue by looking at Beatitude number 7 tonight and focus our attention here in Matthew chapter 5 in just a moment. We've said each evening, particularly those with a large presence of visitors, how grateful we are. I'm sure that the church at Belleville here is encouraged by you coming to join in this effort and being an encouragement to them. One of the things that I haven't mentioned, but I thought I would mention tonight, is particularly those of you who are having your children with you, or your grandchildren with you, or your nephews or nieces with you, or maybe you just picked up a strange child on the way and brought them with you. That's fine, but we appreciate the fact that you're trying to set the right example, and we are not bothered by children crying or being upset. Sometimes we don't even get concerned when adults get upset, because sometimes they get upset too over certain things in the sermon. If it's something that upsets you because of a need to make some sort of a spiritual change, then get upset about it and then make the change and move on. Glad you're here. There's so many people here tonight that I've known through the years, and I appreciate you taking the time to be here, and hopefully we can do some good. We have done, throughout the course of our time together, a study of the Beatitudes. These are 8 simple statements that are almost poetic in nature. Blessed are the blank, for they shall blank. There's some result or some gift or some thing good that happens to them. And we began by talking about those who are poor in spirit. We talked about those who mourn, who are meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who are merciful, and last night, those who are pure in heart. These Beatitudes begin what we refer to as the Sermon on the Mount, the single longest recorded sermon by Jesus ever in the New Testament. And these are, in many ways, the introductory statements of Jesus, such that if we're going to understand Jesus' message and mission, in many ways, understanding these 8 statements helps us a lot. And the word Beatitude, albeit not a biblical word, is certainly a biblical concept because it's from the same word as being more fortunate or being happier. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul is writing a letter and he says, this person is happier, and the word that he uses there, happier, is the same word that is being used here in Matthew chapter 5. And so when we read, for example, in verse 3, where we began a few days ago, blessed are the poor in spirit, another way of reading that is more happy or happier are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. One last thing by way of introduction that we have tried to stress throughout this series is that the happiness that God wants us to have and allows us to achieve is oftentimes in direct contrast to the happiness that is offered or suggested in the world, in that we are doing things in following these 8 things that on the surface and to people in the world who don't have a spiritual mindset make absolutely no sense. And in fact, you can make an argument that by putting others first and by seeing myself as insignificant and by trying to be kind and mild and gentle, you could make the argument that my life is actually not going to be happy, but it's going to be a lot more challenging. And that's true to a degree. But the point that Jesus is making here is that real happiness is not that which the world provides or is trying to get us to go towards, but rather is something that is so different that only when we have a spiritual mindset can we really appreciate it. That is certainly true with the second to last beatitude, and we focus our attention tonight on verse 9, where Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. As with so many of the other Beatitudes, you have to really understand the context in which Jesus is speaking. And it seems to me that there are 3 really important or key things to make sure you kind of stick in your brain when you're reading this verse. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. three things to remember. Number one, remember that these Beatitudes were written by God, were suggested by Jesus, so as to be the polar opposite of earth-based wisdom. That is to say that indeed you have people in the first century who are thinking indeed that wisdom is based on things in this world, achieved through methods like we talked about last night, by having a great family background, or maybe being very educated, or having a lot of money. And so here in the text, Jesus is saying that's not the case at all. And so virtually everything that Jesus is saying in Matthew 5, 3 through 10 is going to be in direct contrast to what the Pharisees were suggesting. Remember, secondly, that most of the Jews were looking for, shall we say, a less than meek king. Remember Beatitude number 3 in verse 5? It says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What is it that the average Jew was anticipating or desiring or looking for at this time? They were looking for someone to come to be their king, literally. They were looking for, to borrow the phrase that we used a few nights ago, a warrior king. Someone who would come in and suggest to the Jews that we are now ready for a revolution and we are going to destroy the Romans, we are going to take over, and we are going to have our power restored to us. But instead, what ends up happening here is Jesus comes along as one of the most gentle, kind, down-to-earth people in the entire world. Remember that these Jews were not ready for a Jesus who was less than the king in their minds. And thirdly, remember that these were the same Jews who were wanting a military campaign. They were wanting someone to come in bearing a sword, coming in with a helmet saying, let's go into battle. And then Jesus comes in with the opposite mentality saying, submit yourself to the government. Whatever the government asks of you, even if it is really unfair, go ahead and do that. These are the kinds of things that aren't going to make you a lot of friends. And in fact, it got Jesus into such trouble that they wanted to kill him. And ultimately, they would seek to put him on the cross. So remember that when Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, that they shall be called sons of God. And we look at that and say, wow, that's beautiful. Many of the people who would have heard that statement would have found it offensive, because that's not what we as Jews are about. When it comes to peacemakers, there are some myths that we need to clear up. Let me suggest a couple of things very quickly. Number one, peacemakers are not pushovers. We talked about that very briefly a couple days ago. But the idea is just because you want peace and are no longer going to fight, and you're trying to make it so that people get along with each other, doesn't make you a pushover. Similarly, being a peacemaker doesn't make you a weakling. We've all probably known people, whether it be in elementary school or whether it be in our adult life, whether it be in our families or our friends or in our workplaces, who, when we did not engage in the kind of conflict that seemed to be apropos to normal society, they thought that we were weaklings, that we were unwilling to stand up for our rights and do what was necessary for us. We said, well, I want to be a peacemaker. I'm looking for calmness in this world. And thirdly, peacemakers are not, shall we say, unprincipled go-alongs. What I mean by that is we don't want to be the kind of people who, when someone asks us a question about a spiritual topic, that we want to keep the peace so much that we are willing to accept anything, that we are willing to allow anything, and that we will not speak our minds. And so being a peacemaker doesn't mean that you don't have convictions. But it does mean that you strive to make for an environment wherein peace can transpire. More about that in just a few moments. If being a peacemaker meant that you were a pushover, a weakling, or an unprincipled go-along, then Jesus would be all three. Jesus was the king of peacemakers. And we associate him with this prince of peace, to borrow from a New Testament term or phrase. Well, Jesus was not a pushover. Jesus was not weak. And Jesus was not someone who says, well, I don't care about principle. Whatever you want to believe, whatever you want to suggest, and whatever you want to teach is fine. In going back to the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 9, in verse 6, it says, unto us a child is born. In this prophecy about Jesus, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and what do you know? Prince of Peace. And so being a peacemaker is going to be unnatural, and it requires determination to be different. That's something that we have said in each of the previous six segments. Doing these seven things, and in total eight things, are things that are uncomfortable and unnatural and things that are learned behaviors. It is not natural to be meek. It is not natural for us to be a peacemaker. It is not natural for us to do any of the eight things that Jesus says we need to do in order to be more spiritually minded. So what I would like to do is, given the fact that we've cleared up, I hope, some misconceptions or some myths about peacemakers, I would like to suggest three truths, biblically speaking, about peacemakers. And the best way to do so is to see what Scripture has to say. Let me suggest three things that kind of identify what we mean by a peacemaker. Number one, peacemakers are individuals who are not selfish. A person cannot say, I am interested in peace, and I want to cause peace to transpire, but I want it to be done my way because it's my way or the highway. That's not the way that peacemakers work. After all, to be a peacemaker, we've talked about the Beatitudes as building blocks. You would have to have already understood the first six Beatitudes. What was Beatitude number one? Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. What did we say that meant? Someone who was willing to see themselves as less significant than anybody else, because the poor in spirit recognize themselves as insignificant. In Philippians chapter 2, in verse 3, when Paul is talking about the mentality of Jesus and the way in which he conducted himself, he's basically making the argument that Jesus is the most selfless person who's ever lived. And in Philippians 2 and verse 3, he says, don't let anything be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. When you are striving for peace, you cannot put your interests in front of someone else's. Why is Jesus the Prince of Peace? Because of verse 3. Because in the English Standard Version, the phrase that is used is that Jesus saw that others and believed that others were more significant than himself. It is going to be very challenging for us to strive for peace when we see ourselves as the most important people. Have you ever been in an argument with someone? Maybe not necessarily where fists were used, but where the words got sharp and the disagreement was significant. And after that argument went on for a while, you realize that you and the person with whom you were having a disagreement were not going to have any sort of acknowledgement of who's right and who's wrong. And one of the quickest ways to end those arguments is to do what? Just stop. It is hard to argue with silence. Now, don't take too much pleasure in it, because we don't want to be smart Alex, but one of the most frustrating things that you can do with an argumentative person to drive them crazy is to not argue back. When they say, well, I believe that this is actually the case, and after the 2 or 3 minutes where you've had this discussion where you've disagreed, no, you're wrong, when you finally say, all right, maybe I am, that'll drive them crazy. But the argument's over at that point. The fact is peacemakers are not so selfish that they have to have their way and they have to always be right. It is okay to say, you know what, I may have been wrong on that. And I would like to think that as we grow and mature as Christians, it's more likely that we create that verbiage as part of who we are on a regular basis in order to strive and keep that peace. Secondly, peacemakers are men and women who try their very best to avoid quarrels. Now, notice I said they try to avoid. There are some quarrels, some disagreements, some arguments that are impossible to avoid. And by the way, I'm not here talking about spiritual quarrels. If you're having a discussion with someone and they say, well, I don't believe that attendance on the Lord's Day or partaking of the Lord's Supper or worshiping God in spirit, I don't think any of those things are important. Having an argument with that person, having a discussion with that person is not only okay, it's necessary to a point, up until the point where you're casting the proverbial pearls before swine. But the fact is in 2 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 24, the text there says that if you are trying to be a servant of God, if you are setting out to do what God wants you to do, you must not quarrel, but instead be gentle to all, able to teach, and patient. Earlier this week, we talked about the fact that a person who struggles with his or her temper cannot say, well, I struggle with my temper so much, so that's just something that I'm going to have to live with and God's going to have to be happy with. Well, that's not true. It may be that that's your struggle, but you've got the responsibility of working towards growing and getting better. Well, here in verse 24, it says, the servant of the Lord must not quarrel. Must not is different than should not. And there's a key difference there. Because it's a matter of, if we are going to be servants, we cannot be quarrelsome individuals. And I think all of us have known individuals, hopefully not too many in the church, but every once in a while they'll sneak in, and we try our very best to help. But we all know individuals who it seems their identity, their purpose in life seems to be arguing, quarreling. That's not a peacemaker. In the book of Proverbs chapter 20, Solomon says there, indeed, you've got to be careful with the things that you say and the way that you disagree with others. He says, it is honorable for a man to stop striving or stop fighting or stop arguing. And then I love the second part of verse 3. Any fool can start a quarrel. An intelligent person, someone of wisdom, can stop by being a peacemaker. But any fool can start a fight. That's what he is saying here. And that's really kind of strong language. And thirdly, peacemakers are truthfully individuals who are willing to suffer unfairly. Remember a few moments ago I said sometimes it's a matter of saying, you know what, you might be right, I might be wrong. And in your mind you're thinking, I know I'm not. I know that he's the one that's wrong, but I'm just going to keep the peace because that's what the preacher man told me to do in verse 9 of Matthew chapter 5. Peacemakers sometimes are going to suffer unfairly, which means you're not going to get your way, which means you're not going to have the final say, which means that you're going to walk away from an argument where the other person thinks he's won. And what's even more challenging is when someone on the outside is watching this argument transpire and you're going to, quote, let them win because you want to keep the peace. Now, everyone's perception of you, because they don't have a spiritual mindset, is, hey, he must be a pushover. He must be a weakling. He must be an unprincipled go-along. Well, that's not what Jesus was, but Jesus was an incredible peacemaker. Many are going to express this false notion about us if we try to be peacemakers. Well, take the time and read 1 Peter 3, 1 Peter 4, 1 Peter 5. We mentioned this earlier, that in 1 Peter, the concept or the word suffer or suffering is used more in that small, short letter than in any other book in the New Testament. And what is the key message that Peter is delivering to those early disciples? Well, he says, when you suffer, make sure that you suffer for doing what is right and not for doing what is wrong. In fact, verse 16 of chapter 4 says, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. Who was it that showed this perfectly? Can you think of someone who wanted peace so much that he was willing to suffer when it wasn't his fault and he didn't do anything wrong? Well, if you can't think of that, well, go out and look at the door as you come in, and there's Church of, and then there's a word. We are the Church of Christ because we're trying to follow Jesus, who showed this perfectly. Jesus is the Prince of Peace because he is the perfect example of someone who says, I don't deserve to suffer, but I'm willing to do so for a cause that is greater than myself. And with all things that are related to God, God expresses a trait that he wants us to have and wants us to show what that means to others. And he has given us everything that is necessary. We know what it means to be a peacemaker. But what I'd like for us to do before we close out this evening is to make sure that we understand what it is that peacemakers do. I want you to consider what peacemakers do and what they do well. Someone who is not a peacemaker maybe does these things, but just doesn't have the ability to do them as well as maybe a saint who has really worked at developing his skill at being a peacemaker. Number one, a peacemaker is someone who works hard to control his temper. That is, I didn't say a peacemaker controls his temper. There's a difference there. A peacemaker works to control his temper. And it's okay to acknowledge, I have a temper. That's a weakness of mine. That's okay. We said that two nights ago. But it is not okay to say, well, I have a trouble with my temper, but I'm not going to do anything about it. A peacemaker works to control his temper because, remember, peacemakers are like the rest of us. They are human beings. And one of the key things that we have in common is that sometimes we do things really well, and sometimes we do things very poorly. Sometimes we look back after a day of our actions and we say, well, I did a decent job today. Not in a pompous way, but I did okay today. And then other times we look back and say, I didn't do okay at all. I let people down. I didn't have the right attitude. I didn't say the right things, or I said the wrong things. And given the fact that peacemakers are human beings, you are going to get frustrated. That is going to be true for each and every one of us. In Proverbs chapter 14, we've quoted from Proverbs almost every night because Solomon has so many wise things to say about being meek and gentle, about putting others first, and certainly at being a peacemaker. And in Proverbs 14, he says in verse 29, he who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. This is one of those occasions where I think looking at some alternative versions is helpful. And I really appreciate what the English Standard Version says here. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly. That is, it is folly for us to have quick tempers. It is going to be challenging for us to be people who instill peace and represent peace if we are the kinds of people who fly off the handle or have short fuses. A peacemaker works to control his temper. Secondly, a peacemaker works to control his tongue. That's different than a peacemaker controls his tongue. Now, if you can get to a place where you have perfected controlling your tongue, more power to you. But for the rest of us, we're still a work in progress. And for the person who says, I've achieved that, let us know. We'll let you preach and the rest of us will sit here and listen. That being the case, it would probably be best for most of us to leave, because someone who is willing to say, oh, I've mastered my temper and I've mastered my tongue, is probably not someone worth listening to, because he's not telling you the truth. Because we're human beings and we struggle and we make mistakes and we have regrets and we have these things that we say, oh, I wish I would not have done that. A peacemaker says, I'm going to control my tongue. James 1. You knew we were going to go there, because this is where James says that a wise man, or someone who is of a scriptural, spiritual mindset, is someone who has worked to control his tongue. Someone who is slow to speak, slow to wrath, but he said be swift to hear. Someone else said it was the idea of having two ears and one mouth, so do twice as much hearing as you do of talking. I get it. I get the irony of that. That someone who makes his living off of doing an awful lot of talking. But the fact of the matter is so much can be learned from listening. And I was thinking about this earlier tonight. I mentioned earlier in the week that no place is perfect to live in the United States or in the world. Every place has its benefits and has its drawbacks. I'm not sure you understand how fortunate you are in central Indiana, for that matter, any place this side of the Mississippi, in having so many congregations so close together. I referenced that a couple days ago. One of the things that people on the West Coast don't get is, you know how you have like baseball season and you've got basketball season and you've got soccer season and you've got football season lasting for 3 or 4 months? Well, Indiana has gospel meeting seasons. There are two seasons. There are spring season meetings, and then there's fall season. Then there's a few summer ones. We don't have seasons in California. Part of that is because if you're going to have a spring season of meetings, you only have two participants, because there's only two churches within so many miles of each other. But I remember one of the great things growing up in central Indiana is, and some of you are doing it, and that is you could go to a different meeting every night, Monday through Friday, When we were younger, we called it riding the gospel circuit. And we thought about putting on the side of our cars that we're riding the gospel circuit. We're concerned about the gospel, but we're also concerned about women because we were trying to go and find different girls at different congregations. Come on. You think that all those meetings that we were going to was just to listen to sermons all that time? But one of the great things about going and listening to so many sermons is you learn an awful lot by listening to others. And in Proverbs chapter 20, again, Solomon, a man who is filled with so much wisdom, has so many great things to say and so few words. He says in Proverbs 20 and verse 19, "He who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters his lips." Sometimes you learn an awful lot, not necessarily by listening to what someone says, but by comprehending the fact that they're saying an awful lot. And they may be talking too much. You've ever heard the phrase, well, he talks too much, or she talks too much. That's usually not a compliment. A page over in chapter 21 and verse 23, "Whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from troubles." That's true. All of us could probably attest to, yeah, I said things because I did not guard my tongue and I got myself in trouble. Well, how can we keep ourselves out of trouble? Well, speak less or be more cautious about the way that we speak. Paul wrote to Titus in the New Testament, and he said in Titus chapter 3 in verse 2, as he was talking about speech and talking about the way that we conduct ourselves, he says, "Speak evil of no one, but be peaceable and gentle, showing all humility to all men." Notice that speaking evil of no one is right next door to the idea of being peaceable. Peacemakers are effective in what they say. That's true. But might I suggest that peacemakers are more effective in what they refrain from saying? Because when you've got an argument that is ready to take off and be lit with fire, you providing fuel by speaking is not helping to provide for peace. But you and I refusing to engage in the conversation, saying, "I'm not going to have anything to do with that," that takes away the fuel. It makes it so that there's no argument to be had. Thirdly, we need to understand that a peacemaker is someone who considers each of the consequences of his actions or of his inactions. I think that Paul is the best person to write on this subject. I want to look at three passages very quickly, all in the Corinthian letters, two in 1 Corinthians and the third in 2 Corinthians. And you'll understand the point that I'm making. Let's read these passages just very quickly back to back. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, in verse 9, he says, "Be aware lest somehow the liberty that you have becomes a stumbling block to those who are weak." Remember what he's talking about here? He's saying, be careful about someone's conscience. Don't allow your own liberty to be a stumbling block for someone else. "If anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple," verse 10, "will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols?" So be careful. Verse 11, "Because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ." And then verse 13, "If food makes my brother stumble," Paul says, "I will never again eat meat lest I make my brother stumble." We use this passage in a lot of different contexts. But one of the key things that Paul is saying here is, if there is something that is going to make for peace that I can participate in, or if my refusal to participate in something will cause peace to happen, I'm all for it. I will do it, whatever it takes. Chapter 9, just a few verses further down, in verse 11. "If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? And then if others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? Nevertheless," Paul says, "we have not used the right that we have, but endure all things lest we hinder the gospel of Christ." Paul says, there are rights that I have as a human being, and God has basically given me a license to either wear that or not wear that, go there or not go there, observe that holiday, not observe that holiday, eat that meat, not eat my meat. God says, I really don't care what you do. But Paul says one thing God does care about is that if you doing any of those things or not doing any of those things is going to get in the way of someone else's better understanding of Scripture or their faithful obedience, then you best not do it or you best do it. And Paul says, I'm willing to do that. And that's not easy. One of the ways that we can make it easier is go back to where we started and not be selfish, because that's so very challenging. And then the third passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 3, where Paul says, "We give no offense in anything that our ministry may not be blamed. But in all things, we," verse 4, "commend ourselves as ministers of God in much patience, tribulation, needs, and distresses." He goes on, for the sake of time, to talk about a lot of ugly stuff that he dealt with. And he says, verse 9, "as unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live, as chastened and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, and as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things." The whole point that he is saying here is that the cause of Jesus Christ and the gospel message is greater than himself or any other person, and peacemakers are well aware of that. In short, a peacemaker will never say, "Well, I have the right to do X, even though I know doing X is going to cause a problem in the local church." A peacemaker will never do that. A peacemaker will sacrifice himself and say, "You know what? I'm not going to participate in that because I know it's going to be a problem over here." Or a peacemaker will say, "This is important for me to say, even though it's going to be challenging for me to put myself out there and put myself in an uncomfortable position, because it's the right thing to do for someone else." Paul says, "I don't care what it takes of me." I've long thought about what it was like the first time that Paul ever ate bacon. I mean, the fact is he grew up his entire life having a certain lifestyle about what he was going to eat and certainly what he wasn't going to eat. Now, it seems quite foreign to us. Why in the world would anyone think that bacon was bad to eat? I mean, it's the best thing in the world. The best thing with bacon is another side of bacon. But the fact is as a dutiful Jew, he says, "I'm not going to eat that." Remember, famously, when Peter was told to eat of these things, he says, "No, they're unclean. I will not have anything to do with them." But can you imagine Paul, who was this chosen vessel to the bacon eaters, can you imagine him going to their house and they set down a platter of bacon and they say, "That's the appetizer. What are we going to have later? Pork loin. What are we going to have for dessert? Pork pie." Can you imagine him saying, "Well, I know it's not really wrong for me to eat those, but I'm not going to do it"? Can you imagine the kind of reception? It's not really the best analogy, but I was talking with a preacher friend of mine years ago who spent some time in Eastern Europe. And as you know, when you go to different places in the world, there are different things that they eat that we would look at and say, "Not going to happen." But I guess the fact that we eat certain things, they would say, "Well, that's odd that you would eat that." And he remembers sitting there with his friend, who was the interpreter, and they bring out what looked like a casserole dish that had like gelatin in it. And in it were little bits of meat, halfway cooked. And rather than being jello, it was fat that had been slightly cured to have a gelatin kind of feel to it. And you could probably shake the casserole dish and you can see the pieces of fat in there and the halfway cooked meat. And he's thinking, "Oh, this is going to be rough." And the man next to him says, "Oh," he says, "you do not understand what this means." And the man's probably thinking, "What, they're going to kill me?" He says, "This is an honor. This poor family will only fix this great dish when someone of honor comes to their house." This man is trying to teach these new Christians. He's trying to encourage these new Christians where churches are now sprouting up in Eastern Europe. And I asked him, "What'd you do?" He said, "I ate it." I said, "Did you like it?" He said, "Nope." But he ate it. Can you imagine what would have happened if he didn't eat it? Now, I'm not suggesting that it's probably good to get sick on your company, but do the best you can. The point is that when we're trying to get the message across, if there's something that's going to help that we have the right to do, then we do it. Let me suggest in closing where it is that peacemakers matter. Peacemakers, the positive effect that they have, the calmness that they give to a church, to society, they are important everywhere. I think all of us would agree that more peace and less fighting, less conflict, less war would be better. But I want you to, in closing, note three particular areas where I think peacemakers are really, really important. Number one, just in society in general. We're not going to take the time to reread Romans 12:2 because we've quoted it almost every night. Where there Paul says, "Do not be like the world, but be unlike the world. Renew your mind to be different." The world is filled with people who love to fight and argue and always be right. If we can dump in a bunch of Christians and mix them into the world and have as us people who say, I'm not going to fight and argue and I'm going to strive for peace, then better is the world for that. What about in families? Every once in a while in a family environment, it may come as a surprise to you that there will be a disagreement. Sometimes children will not agree with their parents. It's rare, but at times it happens, right? Sometimes we have discussions with our children that are challenging and that we don't quite enjoy, and certainly they don't enjoy it as well. But why is it in chapter 5 that the marriage relationship is described as being two people working closely together? Well, it's partly because that's what God wants for marriage, but it's also because that's what he wants children and others to see in a family environment. Why is it in chapter 6 that not only are children to obey their parents, but particularly fathers are to not provoke their children to wrath? Well, because one of the quickest ways to not have peace is to provoke your children to wrath. And thirdly, what about in the church? Now, I would wish as much as you that this wasn't the case. But we've all been around long enough that in any church where there's at least two people, even if it's a man and a woman, who are husband and wife, there's going to be some disagreements. And there's going to be some challenging things. I'm convinced that one of the most challenging jobs that pastors in a church, those who are serving as shepherds are going to have, those who are in the position of elders, their challenge is to keep that peace. I remember years ago, an elder that I had an awful lot of respect for says, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 3, you endeavor to keep the spirit of the unity of the bond of peace. He says that's, in his mind, the most difficult task for an elder or a group of elders in a church. We've got a lot of former elders and current elders who are with us tonight. And I think they would be the first to tell you that they would not be disappointed if taking off their workload was Christians having disagreements, bickering with one another, and having issues with one another. And so I think you would also agree that if you would ever consider serving as a bishop in a local church and you say, but I'm not a peacemaker, something's not going to work well. Because you cannot say, I love strife, I love argument, I love conflict, and now I want to help shepherd people. That's not the way it works. And I don't think that anyone would be silly enough to do that. I almost hasten to use this. I can use this illustration in any place except Central Indiana. So the names and places shall remain anonymous to protect the innocent or protect the guilty, because it was in Central Indiana years and years ago, probably 30 years ago. And the story probably has gotten some legs of its own. I'll mention one person who it was, and some of you will know him. Some of you are related to him. Some of us are related to him. But I remember the local church had the preacher, and there was also a younger man. This is 30 years ago, so some of these people could be dead, but they're not. They're still alive. But some 30 years ago, the older preacher was trying to train a younger man how to preach. Nothing wrong with that, and giving him pointers or whatever. And they got into a disagreement, an argument. And I believe the argument was over how you point your finger when you're trying to illustrate something. You don't do this, you don't do this. I don't know what it was. But I guess the argument got a little bit out of hand. And the young man's fiance happened to stop by the church building. She says, they're going to get in a fight. The two, they're going to throw punches. I'm exaggerating a little bit here. So she gets on the phone. She calls one of the elders, an older man who had been serving for quite some time. And she called Brother Everett Dickey, who is a relative of many of us. And Brother Everett came down to the building, and the way she tells the story is he walks in, and you've got the older man who says, he's not doing it right, the younger man who says, I want to do it the way I want to do it, and Brother Everett just comes in and just settles him down. And nobody else could have done that. He had to do it, because he's a peacemaker. And I've always liked that story. It's silly, and it's kind of goofy that people would argue over those things, and I probably made it a little bit more fun than it really was. But that's what we need in churches. I guarantee you that no set of elders would be disappointed if every member of the church that they are shepherding would say, you know what, I want to be a better peacemaker in the next year. I don't think the elders are going to sit down in one of their meetings and say, we have way too many peacemakers. We have way too many people being nice to each other and trying to get along and resolve their differences. We are bored stiff because we don't have anybody having challenges. It'll never happen because that's not the way it works. But the fact is in churches are humans. You know, there would be no problems in a local church if there were no people. We would fix all the problems if we just fixed all the people or got rid of them all. But that's not an option. God designed the church, and we need peacemakers in the church. And he says, if you are a peacemaker, then you shall be called sons of God. Note that God is the one who calls us his children by saying that we should be called sons of God and not us. Paul tells us that Jesus was essential. Remember in Colossians 1, we won't take the time to read it, but Paul there is talking about being adopted into the family, that we are now heirs to the promise, and we are joint heirs with Christ. There are two very important facts that I want us to think about as we close. Number one, God either praises us and recognizes us and champions us as being his children or not. We are either God's children or we are not. It's one of those two. But fact number two is that you and I are the ones who are in control of how we act and react in difficult times so that we can then take part in that process. So being called a son of God or a child of God isn't something that happens accidentally. But it happens, one, because God chooses it, and two, because we make the effort to be peacemakers who are indeed trying to make peace. So the question to close with is quite simple. What about me? What about you? Are we peacemakers? All of us have known individuals, and I think if we're honest with ourselves, we'll acknowledge that there are times where we have not been the best peacemakers. Instead, we're more like peace wreckers. That's not good for society. It's not good for a family. It's not good for your work environment. It's not good for your neighborhood. And it's certainly not good for the church, both in a local sense and in a more universal whole sense. If you want to become a better peacemaker, first and foremost, that's the best news we've heard all day, because the world needs more of men and women who say, I want to make for a better environment. And not only that, but you are now on your way to becoming the kind of person that Jesus says he wants you to be in these incredible 8 statements called the Beatitudes. You want to have a happier, more fulfilled life? Then be a peacemaker and work toward that. And of course, you can't do that unless you are a child of God. And that's why we always, when we come together on occasions like this, say it's important to be baptized, to have your sins washed away. Acts 2:38, Mark 16:16 teach us that. The Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 was studying from the Bible, so to speak, learned about Jesus, and he says, what keeps me from being baptized? He says, if you believe, you may. And he baptized him right there, Philip did. And he went on his way rejoicing, and you can join in that rejoicing tonight. Glad that you're here, and if you want to make your life right by becoming a child of God, or maybe you need to work at being more peaceable in the future, and you would like to have brothers and sisters pray for you in that effort, we would love the opportunity to help you out. If we can help you or encourage you in any way, let us know while we stand and sing at this time.